You're listening to Girovagando, the cycling podcast at the 2026 Giro d'Italia. The cycling podcast, every day on the ground at the Giro d'Italia since 2016.
Today we are in Sofia.
Talachi, buonasera.
Buonasera, Daniele.
From Sofia in Bulgaria, we have just chin-chined, we've just cheersed, charged our glasses with a spritz.
Si.
The Venetian drink par excellence. Why are we drinking spritz today? Talachi, there's a good reason.
Why?
Venezia, not that, look, Talachi, not that anyone would be thinking about football today. Perish the thought, but Venezia today secured their promotion to Serie A, I believe.
They did. And the Leone di San Marco is back where they belong in the Maximum Series. And we're closer and closer to Valdobbiadene, Conegliano, your beloved region of Italy.
Do you know what? I've got something else. I've got another Venetian link for you today because I was reading about Talachi today. Our pink jersey, still our pink jersey, Thomas Silva. Where he's from in Uruguay, maybe a bit more. I was going to say this until later, but he's from a place in
Maldonado,
right? Which was discovered. And I didn't really understand this because it was discovered, this town in Uruguay in the 16th century, by an Italian with a not very Italian name, Sebastian Cabot, who was from Venice. English educated from Venice, but his mate, his lieutenant, was called Maldonado. For some reason, Cabot didn't take the glory for himself, and they called the town Maldonado, and that's where our pink jersey is from. Palacio, do you want another useless bit of trivia before we get on with the serious business? And we're sitting outside, we're sitting in a huge square in Sofia, outside the NRK, which is where the press room has been, where we've been for the last half an hour or so, and most of the afternoon. It's one of the largest multifunction congress centres in the world. And it was built in the 1980s to celebrate Bulgaria's 1300th birthday.
Wow.
Anyway, Palacio.
Fantastic news.
Glad that's over. How are we doing?
We're doing fantastic. We could see, how do you say? You didn't say column of smoke? A big cloud of smoke.
A big plume of smoke.
Behind our backs, but now it's solved. Apparently a fire maybe broke out near Sofia, but we had a pretty smooth drive today towards the finish line, and so Plovdiv this morning at the start as well. So the main cities of Bulgaria, we checked them all off, right?
Did we? It's been a fleeting visit, and we feel we have only really scratched the surface of Bulgaria, haven't we? But it was nice to be in the capital city today. And what we did see today, Palachi, was some huge, enormous crowds. We drove into the city earlier on and onto these huge, enormous, wide boulevards, which are a bit of a theme, which are a bit of a feature of a lot of these Eastern European cities, former communist states. You've got them in Berlin, in places like Kiev, they have them. And today, well, we saw this, the finish line was on one of them, wasn't it? And that created its own problems. We'll talk about that. But alongside it, we had this enormous cavalcade of amateur bike riders. All ages, every kind of person, it seemed, was on their bike. I don't know how many were doing it. Thousands.
Absolutely fantastic. This other boulevard was just full of people happy with their bike. And this is what I loved about this Grande Partenza the most, I think, how the city of Sofia was able to involve everyone. And the Giro d'Italia was not about, you know, VATS and performances and an elite level of cyclists, but literally all the population was participating. We could see publicity and information being spread. We could see people, even right now, they are looking at us like two awkward
like
people.
We're a couple of celebrities. We're anything but celebrities.
With the caps in a bar in downtown Sofia while recording. They look at us like, oh, there's something new here. Something's happening in Sofia. It's interesting. It's a bike race. They made it something cool, something that should be worth watching.
Yeah, we will definitely leave Bulgaria. I said in a podcast, which was a podcast, I was the one on Chernobyl a few days ago, that the Giro d'Italia will leave Bulgaria probably as it found it, and Bulgaria will carry on with its daily business as though the Giro had not been here. I'm going to correct myself. I'm going to say that's probably not going to be the case, because the Giro d'Italia has left a bit of a mark here, more of a mark than the Giro left in Albania last year. That's what we think.
For sure, for sure. Possibly, even local authorities sort of gained experience from what happened in Albania, and through RCS they made a, you know, an improvement from last year.
Yeah. And the good news is as well, we are going to leave Bulgaria without having been arrested or sued based on our geopolitical insinuations about about Macron and Albania and so on and so on in yesterday's podcast. Palachi, this morning we're in Plovdiv. You've already alluded to that. We alluded to the fact, I think it's the Eternal City it's referred to, it's been inhabited for a long time. That's one similarity with Rome. Another similarity with Rome, built on around, inside a sort of ring of seven hills, is that right?
Yes, but we did not see them. Was it seven, really? I don't know. Maybe yeah. small hills.
Yeah. which was incongruous. But, Palachi, we were curious to find out this morning what damage had been done by that crash in the finale yesterday, that crash 22 kilometers from the finish. We talked in yesterday's podcast about the likes of Adam Yates, who'd come over the line battered and bruised. We knew that other riders had already had to quit the race, the likes of Jay Vine, Marc Soler, they were just two of them. So we wondered who would be starting today and what would we learn about what had happened in that crash. Palachi, you're going to tell us a little bit.
A total of six riders, Daniele, had to leave the Giro d'Italia out right away. So they DNF yesterday are Santiago Buitrago, concussion, neck bruise, Marc Soler because of a pelvic fracture, Jai Vine, as you said, concussion, elbow fracture as well for him, and Adne Holter of UnoX, suspected hand injury and the concussion from him too. Today, two riders did not start this morning from Plovdiv. They are Andrea Vendrame because of fractures to three transverse processes in his lower back. Not looking great for Andrea, the Joker from the Veneto, right?
Yeah, I was about to say. So not all good news for the Veneto today.
And Adam Yates, the third rider of UAE Team Emirates, who drops out. Laceration to his left ear and a concussion for Adam Yates. Wish him the best. And we've got several riders who are banged up as well. Eduardo Zambanini, the likes of Frank van den Broek with a dislocated shoulder, and Casper van Uden with some wrist issues, for example. So, a sprinter today that was not at his best.
Indeed, Palachi. And another rider we knew had come down yesterday was Derek G. And Derek G had come into this race with some, I would say, some GC ambitions. Maybe wasn't aiming, shooting for the top spot, but we knew that. Well, he lost time yesterday. He lost 1 minute and 11 seconds. And we also knew that he had sustained some injuries. So he was one of the riders I was keen to catch up with. Another one, for a couple of reasons, Palachi, was Jai Hindley. Former Giro d'Italia champion, of course. Why? Mainly because we had that moment, which we talked about yesterday, when Pellizzari was down the road and Hindley was kind of marooned behind, and we thought that Pellizzari hesitated a little bit before he started taking pulls on the front with Vingegaard. And I was sort of keen to find out how Jai Rule, to give him his official nickname, how he felt about, I was introducing Palachi in the car to Jai Rule, and who was the other one? Wycliffe Jean, that's another story, today. Anyway, I was keen to find out how he felt about how Pellizzari rode. He ended up telling me some interesting things about the way the race restarted, which was another source of polemica, controversy yesterday. A few other riders slightly upset at the kind of ad hoc manner in which, after the little neutralization when the crash occurred and ambulances were attending to the riders, and all of a sudden the race didn't have enough ambulances. It was sort of restarted in a fairly ad hoc fashion. So we're going to hear Jai Hindley talk about that as well. Hey Derek, give me a health report.
Beaten up, but not so bad. Not so bad, considering how some of the guys ended up. Pretty lucky.
So I can see one injury. Just tell me, what is the extent of the injuries?
Oh, it's a little bit everywhere. Hips pretty bad. Yeah, a little bit on the back, but just hit really hard actually, so didn't come away with too much road rash or anything, just bruising.
And what did you see of the crash? Tell me how it happened.
Oh, I saw guys in front of me hitting the deck, and then I hit the deck, and then I saw a lot of guys on the ground. It's never nice. It's never nice to see. Haven't heard how everyone's doing, but yeah, it was a pretty nasty one.
Super unfortunate. I hope everyone who was involved is okay, and also the guys that didn't start or won't start today, I hope they are all right, because it was really, really nasty. And then it was a big mess also with the restart. I think it was good that the race was neutralized a bit there from the riders themselves, and then at one point the car came in front, which I think was good, but the restart was like a bit embarrassing off the organisation. Pretty pathetic.
It's a difficult one. What should they have done? Because you're obviously really close to the Red Bull kilometer, you're really close to the climb. What should they have done?
For sure, it's hard to say, but I think what they did was good, just communicated better. I think there was no communication, they didn't say anything, and we just started racing, but no one had any idea. So that was pretty poor form, I would say.
Typical cycling, we've seen this many times.
Yeah.
And just on, obviously, Giulio was down the road yesterday. It looked as though initially he wasn't going to pull with Jonas, and then he did. I mean, was that something that came over the radio? And is that sort of how you're going to work it with Giulio, that it's just minute to minute over the radio, the decision's made, you know, who's going to pull and who's not?
Yeah, no, I mean, he had a really good ride. He's also here in really good form, and he's also one of the big favourites. So it was nice to see him yesterday up the road and following the move, and they were also going for the win 100%. Hope to be there on the big mountain days where it's more suited for me. I'm not so punchy, mate. Couldn't punch myself out of a wet paper bag with scissors for hands, so it's not so easy.
We'll see you in Abruzzo when you'll be on home roads.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Interesting. Pellacci, he wasn't the only one, Jai Hindley, who was a little bit upset about what happened as far as the restart was concerned yesterday. Fortunately for him and a lot of the other GC riders, they didn't suffer any consequences. There weren't many big time losses yesterday, were there? One other thing, Pellacci, that I thought I'd bring the listeners up to speed on, there was a slightly enigmatic post. I think it was Marcel Kittel who posted it on social media, or someone in the Unibet Rose Rockets orbit posted yesterday. It was a box of, now Pellacci, I'm going to have to explain this to you, After Eight Mints with Roger scrawled in pen on them. Now, After Eight Mints, Pellacci, they're sort of a signifier of 1980s kitsch, bourgeois kitsch in the United Kingdom. People who are a little bit sort of bourgeois, nouveau rich, ate After Eight chocolate mints in England in the 80s, 90s. To a certain extent, they still do today. Anyway, this was apparently for Roger Hammond, who's the director sportif at Unibet Rose Rockets. I saw Roger this morning. I asked him what on earth this was all about.
Roger, the perils of working for a team that does a lot of social media. We learned about, I assume you've got some sort of, I don't want to use the word fetish, but you like After Eights.
Well, apparently I do now, but apparently it's the... What's the word? Stereotypical British person. So I was bought that as a present from the feed zone, because British people eat After Eights, don't they? But then I did, you know, it did remind me of being at home, you know, when mum and dad, you know, they'd have a posh dinner and the After Eights always come out. So it was like, yeah, it was nice.
So you shared them around the team?
Well, do you know what? I've left them in, I'm not in Team Car 1 today, so I've left them in Team Car 1 so they can have the English experience, or the British experience.
You're not careful, you get a Viennetta today.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's when we get to Italy, isn't it?
And After Eights or Ferrero Rocher maybe to celebrate.
That's it. That and a bit of champagne. That's what we also like. Oh, no, that's French.
Pellacci, that was, I hope, entertaining. But poor journalism from me. I felt as though when I re-listened to that, I felt I didn't really get fully to the bottom of that story. But what Roger did tell me was he also told me that they were going to commit today for the sprint, and they did indeed. They were one of the teams that did pull behind the break. There was no Ferrero Rocher, there were no After Eight to celebrate, but we'll find out now what did actually happen in the
Il prosciuttometro di Michele Pellacci.
Pellacci, please enlighten us on what happened in today's stage.
By the way, Daniele, I love how we talk about carbonara yesterday, chocolate and Ferrero Rocher today. Very good stuff by us.
Pellacci modestly. Anyway, go on.
Listen, we have to start with an excuse to Alexander Vlasov, because we said he DNF yesterday, but he did not.
No, I think this got edited out of the podcast, Pellacci. Our excellent editors, producers.
That's fantastic.
They managed to airbrush your nonsense out of the podcast yesterday.
Stage 3, just like yesterday, featured a pretty weak breakaway. It was low in numbers again, with the same two team of the past days, Polti and Bardiani, sent Sevilla, Tonelli and Tarozzi up the road. Their maximum time gap was around 4 minutes. Then the Borovets climb started with Unibet, Rose Rockets, Little Trek, Sudal Quickstep and XDS Astana working in the peloton. The gap started to decrease. Arnaud Delis was dropped and then made it back to the peloton. Sevilla won another King of the Mountain sprint, and then after that, Tarozzi won the Red Bull Kilometer. Quite surprisingly, the breakaway riders were the first one to pass under the Flamme Rouge and were caught only with 500 meters to go. The team with the best train seemed to be Unibet Rose Rockets, as we mentioned, and it all came down to a three-headed sprint between their sprinter, Dylan Groenewegen, Jonathan Milan, and Paul Magnier. At the end, it was Maglia Ciclamino Paul Magnier who came up with his second win in Sofia.
Indeed, Pellacci in Maglia Ciclamino, Paul Magnier winning for Sudal Quickstep, so he was first. Jonathan Milan, when we were standing by the buses, weren't we, Pellacci, which were sort of parts a few hundred meters from the finish line, and we weren't sure initially when we saw the head-on shot which one of the three it was, but then we saw Magnier celebrate. We thought he might have got it wrong and that Groenewegen might have in fact pipped him on the line. It might end up being an embarrassing situation for Magnier, but he had indeed judged it correctly. Mattis Mikkels, who's had a good few days picking up minor places, he was fourth for EF Education Easy Post. Fifth was Malucelli. Blikra of UnoX Mobility was sixth. Ackermann was seventh. Jaco Lula Ballerini eighth. Tobias Lundt, incidentally, I spoke to our Danish colleagues a couple of days ago, who advised me that we should just drop the Andreessen, just Tobias Lund is fine. That's how they refer to him. So he was ninth. I'm not entirely sure what happened to him today, whether he got slightly lost. He certainly had a lead out of sorts, as did all of the teams, because the road was so wide that I suggested to a couple of people I spoke to after the finish, and they sort of agreed with me that today was sort of a lead out laboratory. It was so wide that every team could pretty much, if they didn't make big mistakes, implement exactly the plan that they probably formulated in the bus this morning, and then it was just going to be a case of who was the fastest. Anyway, Decathlon did have men there, but they did also fall apart to a certain extent. And Zanoncelli was 10th for Bardiani Pellacci.
But it's interesting, Daniele, so the Lund part of Tobias Lund Andersen is part of the surname, not the name?
Tobias Lund is the name. Just forget all the rest, Pellacci.
Right,
just from this day on, he's to be called Tobias Lund. We don't need to worry about anything else. Pellacci, in the GC, Thomas Silva is still leading the Giro d'Italia, still in the pink jersey. Florian Storck of Tudor Pro Cycling Team is still second. More on him in just a second. But he's 4 seconds behind Silva. Egan Bernal is third. Timon Arensman, we're going to talk about him later in the podcast as well, is fourth. Giulio Ciccone, fifth. Jan Christen, who was in the white jersey today, was wearing the white jersey at least, is sixth. Chota of UnoX Mobility is seventh. Johannes Kuhlse is eighth. Erik Maas, ninth. And Lennart van Eetveld, tenth. In the points competition, there were changes on that today. Paul Magnier leads now by a substantial margin. He leads by 41 points, if I'm not mistaken. 105 points he has. Milan is second. King of the Mountains competition, Diego Sevilla, who's been a bit of a star of these first few breakaway, well, they haven't ended with breakaway victories, but his breakaways have certainly characterized these stages. He leads that competition convincingly. 42 points to 12 is the next rider, Tarozzi. Young riders classification, Silva still leads, but Christen will continue to wear the jersey because he is second. And teams classification, we don't need to worry about that just yet, but Astana do lead. Pellacci, I said we would return to Storck and his 4 second deficit on German classification. We're going to hear from Florian Storck later in the podcast, but before we do, one thing to be cleared up today was why Tudor Pro Cycling. We knew it was sort of in the air this morning that they might fancy a little bit of a go at the Red Bull Sprint to get those 6 bonus seconds to get the pink jersey. Why they didn't put guys on the front and pull to bring it back together, bring Sevilla et al. Back close to the finale. Fortunately, we've got an inside man at Tudor Pro Cycling, the Motown Maestro, Larry Warbass. So he's going to tell us why they didn't do that in just a second. But first, we're going to hear from one of the unlucky losers, and disappointed in this case, losers today. I'm loath to use that word, loser. Second is still a very, very creditable performance. But Jonathan Milan, who so far in this Giro is empty-handed. So we're going to hear from Jonathan Milan first, and then Lucky Larry, the Motown maestro, Larry Walbus.
Today we followed the usual planning as a leader train. I think the guys did an amazing job also for the running into the last kilometers. So Matteo Sobrero did a fantastic job. All of them, they support me. Maybe anticipated a bit too much this last corner. I wanted to take a nice speed before this 150 meters of cobbles, because I know that once that you are on it, it's super difficult to stand up and increase the speed, increase the power. Maybe if I see now, I should wait some seconds more for doing this action. But yeah, here's what it is. We learn from it. I'm happy that maybe slowly the condition is going up. We will look for the next ones now.
It's strange to sprint on a road that's that wide. It is every single team had a train across the road.
I mean, I was remembering a bit the UAE sprints finals. So now we're used to this. It was a bit strange to end this last 150 meters on a cobbles, maybe. That's for sure.
So yeah, we thought about it. The thing was, the only way we were going to be able to take the seconds was if we caught them by surprise. And so we decided, like, if it was within 20 seconds, then we go full and try to get it. But already from, like, 15K, 20K from the sprint, Betiol and Malucelli were sitting on Stork's wheel. So in the end, it was like, it would have been kind of a lost cause. You know, there's more days coming, so we thought we'd focus on the next days.
We've got much bigger fish to fry.
Exactly.
Do you struggle to feel the presence of God with you throughout stressful days? Prayer in Motion by Jennifer Tucker shows you how to bring prayer into your daily routine through simple movements and mindful rhythms that draw your heart and mind back to God anytime, anywhere. Get your copy now wherever you buy books.
Well, Palachi, now it's time for us to analyse what actually happened. But before we do, just reassure me, over my shoulder, has that black cloud appeared?
There is not. That's fantastic.
Over your right shoulder, Palachi, incidentally, I wanted to mention that we are overlooked, and Sofia is overlooked by the majestic Cherny Vru.
Wow.
That's probably the wrong pronunciation. But I think it's the fourth highest mountain in Bulgaria, 2,200 and something metres high. Literally means black peak.
Wow.
And first climbed in 1895 by one of the gentlemen who went on to become, or was already at the time, the sort of Dante of Bulgaria, Ivan Vasov. The 300 people all went up Palachi in a big peloton. They were the first fellas, men and women, to climb it. I presume there were women there. I hope there was. And 300 of them, and he was among them. Fancy
interesting
that.
And it reminds me of Dino Buzzati, of course, the great journalist following the Giro and writer following the Giro in the 40s. He was a Veneto and he was a climber himself.
Yeah, he's, and he been, would have known all about En Rosadira that we discussed yesterday.
Yep.
Palachi, the man mountain who so far is dominating the sprints in this Vuelta a España. Why did I just say Vuelta a España? What possessed me to say that? Giro d'Italia is Paul Meunier. If I'm not mistaken, today was his 28th victory as a pro, which is quite extraordinary, given how long he has been a professional, how short his career has been until this point. But would you agree with me, and would you agree with those that I already referred to, that I'd spoken to after the finish, who sort of suggested that today was a pure sprint, and what we saw today, what we got, was a clear photograph of the current hierarchy of sprinters in this Giro, not Vuelta?
Could be true, but I don't want this sprint to leave us with an old black and white situation, right? The guy who won, Meunier, has something else, something better than anyone else, but I think we're literally talking about centimeters, right? He won for half a wheel of a bike, so maybe 20, 30, 50 centimeters. He's not the only one who did something right. Meunier, fantastic. Milan, Groenewegen, Mikkels, they're not losers who can go home and their Giro is not over. I wouldn't be surprised if at the end of the day At the end of the Giro d'Italia, Jonathan Milan comes up with the Maglia Ciclamino. Or Grona Vanega, for instance, because they showed great form.
Yeah, I mean, Milan, he said, we heard him say he thinks he's getting better, but it was interesting what he said about the cobbles. And I felt, and I think you can hear in that interview, what he wanted to say was that this race today should not have been finishing on cobbles, that that wasn't worthy of a finish of the Giro d'Italia. And it was a little bit strange because if you go back and look at the finish and look at the last few kilometres, I mean, we drove the last few kilometres and the road surface wasn't great about 10 kilometres to go, 9 kilometres to go, but the sections closer to the finish line, so sort of 1 kilometre to go, you know, it was normal. It was asphalt. And if the race had finished there, it would have been very sort of straightforward or very orthodox in terms of sprint finishes. But they did finish on the cobbles, I presume, because they wanted to finish in front of a certain landmark or in a certain place. And it added a different dimension. I don't think it made the sprint any more dangerous. I don't know. I might be mistaken. I know that you spoke to Jasper Stuyven and he thought that it was dangerous generally. Did he qualify that?
Good question. I think what made it even more dangerous was the fact that from -2 to -1, there was a 25 meters.
We were very excited about this downhill when we did it in the car.
It was downhill and it was, I think they were going 80k per hour down there. And I think about Jonathan Milan, he's close to my heart as an Italian. I think he looked very powerful again. He looked on top of everything, on top of everyone else for most of the sprint. As he always does, his distinctive style made him jump off the television again, but once again, he stayed at the wind a bit too much, I think.
Yeah, I mean, he said there that these cobbles sort of got in his head. He had it in his head that, and I'm just watching it now, the cobbles start with, it's about, is it 150 to go or 100 to go? He had it in his head that the first man to get to the cobbles was going to be the man who won this race, and consequently, well, there was a sort of calculus that dictated he had to go a little bit earlier than he would ordinarily have liked. I mean, the other thing is that in the last 600-700 meters, his team were really nowhere to be seen. I mean, he sort of paid tribute to them. He said they did nothing wrong in that interview with me. But, you know, you look at Unibet Rose Rockets and they were sort of lined up beautifully on the right-hand side of the road. And I don't think Milan had the best lead out today.
Once again, I have to admit, that's been the case. And he also, if you look at it closer and with the, you know, slow motion, I think Jonathan Milan on the cobbles, he lost half a stroke of a pedal. And that might have resulted in him finishing second instead of first, maybe. A lot has been discussed about Milan because his, you know, unorthodox sprinting style has been an issue of debate. On platforms such as former Twitter.com, Italian fans are angry at him. I think he moved that way because that's the way he can produce the max power. If he wouldn't be able to...
Explain that. He moves which way?
He moves... You know, he has a sprinting style that's so particular. He's not very beautiful to watch. He just looks as like a man possessed by power and strength. And we see the stats on Velon, for example, on Instagram, more than 2,000 watt peak strength, peak power for him. Huge numbers. It's true that he has a lot of volume for the wind to, you know, to be...
Yeah, it's a huge, he's a huge man, isn't he? And, yeah. You know, Magnier himself is a big guy. I referred to him a second ago as a man mountain. And Magnier is often compared, Soudal Quickstep, obviously, one of their emblematic riders over the last couple of decades was Tom Boonen. And he's often compared to Tom Boonen, and it's often said that he could become a Boonen. And obviously, it didn't pan out like that in the classics this year for him, but people see that in his future. I don't know, Palacci. I feel that Milan, you can see if you watch it back, you can see maybe did lose a bit of momentum on the cobbles. The cobbles themselves were not severe cobbles, yeah. But they were enough definitely to affect sprint, weren't they? As for Groenewegen, I think he'll take a lot of heart from today's. I think from today's sprint, I think he will feel that there is a stage win for him somewhere in this Giro d'Italia, particularly with the lead-out train that he's got, who, you know, looks as though it's functioning very well. As we said the other day, they've got Marcel Kittel here, and you know that there's a good there's a sort of positive dynamic around that team you feel at the moment. You know, they're thrilled to be here. They don't have the same pressure that, you know, Little Trek is one of those teams that has declared and they've made it very obvious and very clear that the very pinnacle of the World Tour is where they want to be, where they want to go. And that adds a certain amount of pressure. Milan, the fact that he's at the Giro d'Italia this year, not at the Tour de France, that adds pressure as well, because it sort of creates the expectation that he's going to be the dominant sprinter here, because the Giro is a lesser race. Yep, yep. We know that the level of sprinters here is pretty high, actually, and the level of lead out trains is pretty high. But if he doesn't win 2-3 stages, if he doesn't sort of live up to the bar, meet the bar that he set in previous Giri, then he's going to be disappointed. Little Trek are going to be disappointed, and people are going to tell them they should be disappointed as well. Who knows? Who knows, Pellacci? It could still turn out to be a grande riserva Giro d'Italia for Jonathan Milan, which reminds me, Pellacci, which reminds me, grande riserva, of course. What is the full name? I always forget the full. Cardinale. Riserva del Cardinale.
Perfect.
Okay, for those who haven't been listening to the cycling podcast over the last few days and didn't listen to the Giro d'Italia last year, Pellacci's family owns a Parma ham empire. They are like the sort of Steve Jobs of Parma ham, or the Apple, the Google of Parma ham, like the Lavazza to coffee in Bulgaria. They're huge. Anyway, the Grande Riserva del Cardinale is your
top label.
It's the top label. Anyway, that reminds me. But actually, we did the prosciuttometro, and you didn't even say how many slices of prosciutto you're giving for today's stage out of 5.
Daniele, you know how much I love my Italian teams, right? Bardiani and Polti. And they were involved in the final a lot, because, quite surprisingly, as we said, they were caught only inside the final kilometer. And for a moment, we were like, can Bardiani win? On next Sunday, it will be the 10th anniversary of the last win of Bardiani at the Giro d'Italia. It was Giulio Ciccone in Sestola. And I thought, oh my goodness, could this be the day? Unfortunately not, but this excitement made me give 3 prosciutto out of 5. I think it's... I gave this...
Have we had 3 every day so far?
Yeah,
this goal.
Yeah, every day. You know what? Fine. It was a solid start at the Giro.
Without those last 5 kilometers, when the heart rate did rise a little bit, we could have been heading for not a vegan sort of no prosciutto day, but maybe a bit of a sort of more of a vegetarian inclined kind of day.
We had 3 days, Daniele, of racing. Only 2 teams have been in the breakaway.
Okay, have we had any ciclismo yet? Or has it been more high rocks than ciclismo?
Perfect. But I was also happy for Manuele Tarozzi. Do we have 30 seconds.
Just 30 minutes. We definitely don't have 30 minutes to talk about Manuel Tarozzi.
But this Tarozzi guy, he's from my region, Emilia Romagna. And you know, my brother was a cyclist. And similar age to Tarozzi. And they were competing against each other in the youth ranks quite a bit. And so a funny story about Tarozzi is that my brother told me, to celebrate a good race for Tarozzi, he once ate 1 kilo of gelato. And it was not good for his stomach, of course. He had stomach problems for 1 week after that.
Do we know what flavor?
We don't.
Okay.
Probably a mixture of flavors.
This sounds like the kind of thing that Jan Ulrich used to do on a regular basis. Pellacci, incidentally, a few years ago now, we bumped into each other at the Filippo Ganna Hour Record in Kranken in Switzerland. And I remember we went out for a little drink that night, a nice soiree, and we were driving either there into the town or away from the town, and you knew that I had a book coming out about Jan Ulrich, and you said, who is this Jan Ulrich? Was he a cyclist? Yeah, that's the level. That's what I'm dealing with. Pellacci, should we move on? So, as we've established, Silva is still in the pink jersey. I was going to leave this until later, but I will say it now. I think yesterday we referred to the fact... Well, we already talked about the town that he's from in Uruguay. Yesterday, of course, we talked to his family. Mm. Yesterday, I think I referred to Uruguay as the Switzerland of South America.
Yep.
Which is I didn't come up with that. That's commonly said. Why is it said? Well, I just looked up a couple of statistics on that today, and they have the second highest GDP per capita in South America. Wow. Of any country after Guyana. Guyana's a very small country, so that feels like a bit of a fake news stat. So really, it's the richest country, richest big country in South America. But what makes this very incongruous and ill and poorly fitting, this denomination Switzerland of South America? Uruguay also has the lowest, highest point of anywhere in South America. It doesn't really have any mountains. I think the highest point is about 500 meters above sea level. But other economic sort of markers that have led to it being likened to Switzerland, it's just a very stable, reliable financial system. A lot of sheep in Uruguay. I think twice the number of sheep to people. Ratio of sheep to people, but twice. Renewable energy, over 90% of energy in Uruguay is from renewable sources. So, yeah, that's why Thomas Silva is said to come from the Switzerland of Latin America.
I want to move to Uruguay now, except for the lack of mountains.
There you go. Pelacci, we're going to sort of veer towards the mountains now, because we're going to talk about a GC rider. Yesterday, did we mention this in the podcast? I can't remember. But one of the things I was curious about yesterday was how Tymon Arensman of Net Company Ineos was going to fare. Because we had this reference point of last year in Albania, first stage, a hilly stage, where he's really suffered and he lost time. And I did refer to this in the podcast a few days ago, that he sort of opened up after the time trial. In fact, the next day he said, look, I got tense, and this is a problem that I've had, a recurring problem, and I need to find a solution to it. I don't know how I'm going to find a solution to it, but I need to work on this, making sure that at the start of Grand Tours, the stress, the hype, everything doesn't get to me. I would have liked to talk to Tymon Arensman this morning about this, but I was told that he's locked in and he didn't have time, didn't have the headspace for interviews. But I was offered a good alternative, and that alternative was speaking to Geraint Thomas, who, of course, and I don't have his official title to hand, but I think most of the listeners know now that he's in the management. He's sort of kind of team manager, and I don't think he's performance director.
And Giro d'Italia runner-up.
Exactly, 3 years ago. Anyway, Geraint is at the Giro d'Italia here in Bulgaria. He's not coming back to the Giro d'Italia, he told me. But I thought he'd be an interesting guy to talk to about this, how they'd prepared Arensman mentally for this Giro d'Italia, and whether it was something that he ever encountered in his career, the difficulty mentally bearing the weight of the pressure that is on a team leader in a Grand Tour. And he obviously knows a bit about that, having won a Tour de France and having led a Giro d'Italia up until the penultimate day in 2023. So today's Chiacchierata del Giorno is me in conversation with Geraint Thomas about precisely that. Here it is.
La Chiacchierata del Giorno. The chin wag of the day.
Yeah, I think it's, as you say, there's a psychological side, really, because he was in good shape and things. And I think when there's a lot of narrative around you as well, it's easy to just be sucked into that. And I think it's just continuing the simple messaging, really. And it's huge credit to Adrian Lopez, his coach. He's been, for me, that's what a coach is all about, you know. It's not just about numbers and this and that. It's the whole psychological side. And they've got a really good working relationship and a lot of trust. And I think they've just really worked on that, and it's not about this one race, but you know, in Alps we saw, you know, he was good from the start, and I think, you know, you can take confidence from past experience as well and not just see the negative. And I think, yeah, just chapeau to the work they've all done, because been a great start, but still 19 days to go. So it was but it's very, really encouraging, because you look at him, like, physiologically as an athlete, yesterday's not his ideal day, but he still got through it really well, you know, cause the fact that the first day was easy. Yesterday was, you know, it was building up, and then they had the neutral, and then went again. And fair play to him; it's good to see.
It's something that people might find harder to understand in cycling than in a sport like, I don't know, whether it's tennis or golf, where you often get stories of people, you know, sort of tensing up. Did you experience that in your career ever? That nerves really can play a big part and really impact your performance.
Oh, massively, because it's like, you know, I think I was quite lucky. I kind of...
So you're the least, you seem to be the least nervous person always, but...
I don't know, my dad, the way I was born, I don't know, but my sort of base level was pretty good with that. But I still obviously got nervous and still tensed up at times, and you still overthink things and you doubt yourself and confidence can wane a bit. And it's always the same going into a Grand Tour. Like, you know where you're at, you know you're good. Be like, oh, how's Jonas or Pellizzari or, you know, who, everyone else, how are they going to be with me? Am I going to get dropped today? And like, which is ridiculous when you actually, like, when it's somebody else. Like, and if it's like, so if you got a twin now and they're in exactly the same shape as you, what would you say to them? And you'd be all, say exactly that, you've done the work, it's not, you're going well, look at your numbers, you've done PBs for your 10 minutes, whatever. What are the chances of getting dropped? Oh, well, not a lot at all, really. But so why are you stressing about that? You know, just get out there. Are you going to go out there and try and get dropped? Of course you're not. So you're going to go out there and do your best. So just accept that. For me, you come to a Grand Tour now and everyone here, no one's going to get fitter. You know, it's okay unless you're in bad shape, but physically you're at where you're at. Your body comp is where it is. You've still got to watch it the first week because I tend to put on a weight sometimes. But in general, that's where it's at. The only thing that's going to make the difference now is the mental side. If you can race how you want and not get drawn into like panicking and doing something silly, or you know, getting overwhelmed, be like, oh, I don't feel great today. There's so many times when you don't feel great and you do a really good ride, you know, and those two don't really correlate, you know, at the same time. So there's a lot into it, and fair play to back to Timon, you know, he's worked a hell of a lot on that, and just the psychology of it and how he's gonna react and, well, just treat the situation, and just to help him stay calm and have those systems in place really to deal with different things.
You talked about his coach. You guys also have psychologists as well in the team, don't you?
Yeah, Steve Peters is obviously he's a lot more involved again, which is really good. And you know, even from my side, like, I've been working with him just as a from a communication, and you know, obviously going into this new role, like, you deal with him with different cultures and different, just different people, and now it's a completely different relationship with me and them, and so it's helping me with that side of things as well. And then obviously with the riders, he's a lot more involved again, which I think is a huge benefit, as you know, I've already mentioned really.
So he would have been involved in some way with Timon yesterday or before yesterday?
Well, yeah, he's certainly available. I'm sure they have a good relationship. I don't want to speak specifically about Timon working with him, but there's definitely a number of riders that are working with him, and he's having a good impact. Yeah.
Just last thing then, Geraint, what was the occasion in your career when you felt most nervous? I'm thinking about times where there was an obvious reason to be nervous, those time trials, Giro 2023, Tour de France 2018. When was the time when you felt psychology was the biggest thing you had to overcome in a race?
I think the team pursuit probably helped me with all that, because that was suddenly, it's like 4 years work and it's down to a matter of tenths of a second. Well, not in Beijing, we smashed them in the end, but I think... But no, before it, it's and London, and so I think that was really good in setting me up for. And then, yeah, I think the Tour, as you say, and the Giro were two of the nerve-wracking ones, because the Tour was suddenly, I was like, geez, I can actually win the race today. I was like, actually, no, don't be thinking that, you know, get back into the zone almost, you know, in that process of, you know, just do what you got to do in each section of the race, visualize that. And sounds boring, which it kind of is, but for me, that's what you got to do. And so, yeah, the Tour and the Giro were tough ones. And just in general, you always doubt yourself. Like, I, not everyone, but there was always, like, going into every new year, you're like, whoa, how's this, how am I going? Like, you're always comparing yourself to the past. Like, you always want to be better because the sport's always moving on. So, but all those type of things, like, just chatting to the riders in a more casual way as well, you know, not a formal, like, that's why now, you know, I try and go to dinner with them or on the bus with them and breakfast, and you just, those general chats and then stuff like that just naturally just comes out. And I think if I can, for me, I think that's the biggest way I can help the guys in that sort of way. So hopefully they feel the same, but no, it's all good.
One question. Picture yourself a few months from now at one of the dinner parties that the Hagues are famous for organising in Andorra, and one of your guests ask you, what's Bulgaria like? What's your answer?
I would say I was surprised at how beautiful some of the scenery was. Like where we finished yesterday and we were driving to here, it was quite beautiful with a sort of low forest. But then around the area that we started, I was surprised how quiet it is. We saw, okay, cars pass us, but we didn't really see that many people once you left the city. But it's a nice city. I think I didn't see anything yet that maybe would encourage me to come back for a holiday, but it did maybe spark my curiosity for more of Eastern Europe. And I think definitely if we'd spent more time in Sofia, it would have been a little bit more interesting.
Ben, this study will never pass peer review because I've only asked Australians so far, but imagine yourself in a few months talking to your friends, they say, what's Bulgaria like? What's your answer?
I don't really know what I could use to describe it, to be fair. We haven't actually been lucky enough to see the good places yet. I think there's plenty of nature and wildlife around. There's probably more of the allure. But yeah, I wouldn't be jumping into the Black Sea. It's too cold.
Great answer. First thing to say on the route today, so not such a long drive today, mercifully, compared to yesterday, which was an epic. Mainly on the biggest motorway, I think, the main artery, shall we say, that crosses Bulgaria.
It's called A1, just like A1 in Italian.
Exactly. We just saw a couple of cyclists doing a Trofeo Baracchi on the motorway.
Should we get Florian?
Florian.
We have to bring you on the podcast for a sec.
Florian, find me. Okay, so Florian, Larry, he's often on our podcast. I remember a couple of years ago, you'd had a good result somewhere, and I said, Larry, tell me something about Florian Storck. And he said something like, oh, he's got a brother or a sister. And that was all you...
What?
That was the only insight you had.
He does have a brother. No.
But I know...
I would have said something about his dark humor that I appreciate. That.
Florian, what's the master plan to get you the pink jersey today?
I mean, there is a bonus sprint with 6 seconds on the line. That could be an option. But if it doesn't unfold there, there are still some good stages to come next week to try and go get the pink.
If we have to slash tires, we will, you know?
I remember one thing you did say about him, he's very strong. I've also met you study Germanistic in Cologne. You read Steppenwolf by Hermann Hesse. I've read that as well. Larry, look at that.
It is some years ago, eh? True, yeah.
So you confirm, he's strong, he's talented. You can go, Florian, thank you. You can go. I think we need to
just pass the big Rotololi Regina, you know.
The inflatable toilet rolls.
Exactly, the toilet rolls that are sponsor of the Giro d'Italia, and now we are heading towards the finish line.
I would just like to make a call to the cycling podcast listeners to share their...
Pelacci. A cliffhanger there. That was deliberately cut off when Larry said, I want to share something with the cycling podcast listeners. I think that's what he said. We want to know from the listeners, from you, the listeners, what do you think Larry was referring to? What did he want to be shared, do you think? Give us your best responses. Don't try and slide into Larry's DMs and ask him, because I briefed Larry on this at the finish. When I saw him at the finish, I said, Larry, if anyone asks you to reveal what it was, then block them and report report them to Mark Zuckerberg. Anyway, Pelacci, we're trying to be more interactive, Pelacci, which we're soliciting questions from the listeners every day on this Giro d'Italia. And we've got, and thank you for your questions. I got a few on Strava, some good ones, some interesting ones that range from sort of East Germany, literature on East Germany, to various other things. So they're starting to come in now, the questions, Pelacci. And you got an interesting one as well.
Yes, from Mr. Dylan McDaniel on my Instagram. And he asked, it's a long question, but a very good one. Is the refusal of any major of the teams to even try and form a real breakaway just the peloton and the teams quite quitting because of the Bulgarian start along
quite transfer? Quite quitting. You had to explain this phrase to me.
Yeah, because it means, you know, when you, for example, you want to quit a job and you don't want to tell the boss and you just basically stop working, but you do that in a quiet way. You pretend you're working, but you're not. And so everybody is like...
like what you're doing on the Giro d'Italia. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, quiet quitting. So, good question. We were asking ourselves kind of the same question, similar questions about... So, yesterday, for example, right, Daniele? Super long stage. Only one team was in the breakaway. What were the other 22 teams thinking?
Yeah.
All of them thought they had a real shot at not just win, but just UCI points. Because remember, only the 15 riders who get from 1st to 15th get the points.
Yeah.
That's not much.
Yeah.
And, for example, teams that do not have the Giro d'Italia as the top priority, such as Groupama FDJ, Picnic, PostNL, they couldn't send anyone to the start of the... Also, remember, Daniele, I was talking to Giovanni Elena, director sportif for Polti Visit Malta this morning. He told me they were watching the power files of Mirko Maestri last night. Mm. They said at that speed, it was around 38 kilometers per hour, not much for pro cyclists, for 5 hours. They said Mirko Maestri could have gone on that speed for 12 hours. Because that's zone one for them. Mm. Would be zone five for me and for you.
Hang on. maybe that's the future of the Giro d'Italia. We've been talking about the identity crisis of the Giro d'Italia, how it should be designed. You know, obviously, the Vuelta has had success with short stages. Maybe that's the future of the Giro d'Italia. You have 12-hour stages. I don't know.
Interesting, but I was talking to riders this morning from Polti, from Bardiani, had a chat with Bruno Reverberi, the 80 years old, I think, director sportif for Bardiani. And they were like, as long as we can have the spotlight, it's a manner for them to show the sponsors, to show the riders, to show... Giovanni Elena told me, our golden particulars or sprinkles on the bike.
Mm.
You know, Aurum bikes, Contador, Ivan Basso are part of it.
Okay.
And they've got a golden details
sprinkles
on the bike.
This is intriguing. I'm not sure we saw them on TV, golden sprinkles. Yeah,
possibly I used the wrong word. Possibly. Right, okay. Yeah. But you know, it's an opportunity for them.
Yeah, and look, today underlined the fact that particularly in modern cycling and with you know, how aero the bikes are and the clothing is. We've seen this and we've heard from riders over the last few years. You know, we've seen that breakaways don't get 10 minutes anymore. Why don't they get 10 minutes? Partly because the peloton is scared and they know that an individual rider can go very, very fast, or three riders in a breakaway can go very, very fast. I don't even hear people referring to it anymore. The old dogma, the old rule about 1 minute per 10 kilometers, it is completely, that is old news. Old news, fake news. So in 2 years, in two Giro d'Italia, say two or three Giro d'Italia, if you do this every day, what Bardiani and Polti Visit Malta are doing, it will probably work once. And that's not a bad return. If even every 3 years they get one Giro d'Italia stage win, that's not bad. Pellacci, you also shared with me earlier that didn't Roberto Reverberi say utterly immortal words, better to live one day as a lion than 100 years as a sheep, which is kind of unfortunate because it's a phrase, it's an expression, a proverb that was famously used by Mussolini.
Daniele, what do you want me to say about, you know, the...
But it is common, we shouldn't accuse him of anything too extraordinary or anything too unusual, because it is a common phrase. Okay, Mussolini was the most famous person to utter those words, but it's common parlance in Italy.
Daniele, I'm such a big fan of Bardiani. I want them to succeed. Okay. Please, Bardiani, win a stage this week in Italia.
Pellacci, that reminds me, we were talking about political correctness, I hate that phrase, the other day, but we used an expression, a colleague of ours did, and I expressed my admiration for Jonas Vingegaard for understanding what cakewalk meant, because it was put to him that, oh, you know, people are saying this Giro d'Italia is going to be a cakewalk for you, and he responded in a way which suggested he understood the question very well. And we then did a bit of a deep dive into where that expression comes from. I'm not going to recapitulate that for the listeners now. You can find out yourselves on Wikipedia. But and the origins of it are slightly ambiguous. Like a lot of these things, there's a sort of story, there's a version of how that expression came to be, and there are various other versions as well, so it's not completely set in stone, but it might be slightly politically incorrect as well. Anyway, Pelati, should we move on from the breaks? But, you know, interesting topic, isn't it? That we've seen this becoming more and more of a theme. And I said before the Giro d'Italia, I don't want a Giro d'Italia where every day we get Polti visit Malta and Bardiani going away in a break and a fairly sterile spectacle behind, because it jars, it kind of clashes with what we see at the Tour de France. We don't get the equivalent of this at the Tour de France. We don't even, to a certain extent, we do at the Vuelta, but not to the same extent. And the Giro, I just worry that the Giro is becoming something quite different from those races. You know, we've talked a lot in the last few years about cycling becoming more exciting, more aggressive, more crash bang wallet, more heavy metal. And the Giro sort of gives lie to that trend. It goes against that trend.
You're correct. For example, you remember the two-man breakaway of Alpecin De Koenig back then at the Tour de France, yes, with Mathieu van der Poel and teammate Ricard?
Yes.
They were doing
Châteauroux, to Châteauroux.
50k per hour for 4 hours. We're talking about 38 here at the Giro. And there's a huge discrepancy there. But Daniele, you, a couple of days ago, you enlightened me on the Tour de France that was won by a gentleman who gained
Oscar Pereiro.
I don't know.
Gained 28 minutes. Yeah.
Wonderful story. Hopefully Tarozzi will be the same story.
Yeah, it's never going to happen again. Pelacci, just one of the things to clear up from the last couple of days. Was it yesterday? Wasn't it? When we had our Chiacchierata del Giorno with Mark Rafe of Visma Lisa Bike, and this decision that team has made to be a bit more low-key in the sprint stages. And we saw it again today. Visma Lisa Bike conspicuously sort of opting out of the big fight for position. And again, this goes against recent trends. We've seen this for the last 10 years. GC teams, or going back to Team Sky and way before that, in fact, GC teams with their leader really fighting hard for position until the point where it's neutralized, whether it's 3 kilometers or 5 kilometers or whatever. And we saw it again today. One thing that's been said, and it's been pointed out to me by people who listened to that interview, was that you're likely to have a lot of riders then who are well down the general classification, which is the case with Visma Lisa Bike, which means that you're likely to have a car that's a long way back in the convoy. And indeed, Visma Lisa Bike were the 21st car in the convoy today. And if there are issues, if there are problems, then that's going to be additional delay in terms of, getting help for Jonas Vingegaard. And again, you know, we talked about it yesterday. It's a big risk. Although I did get quite a bit of feedback from listeners today as well, saying, well, look, this is a really good thing. That's exactly what the GC teams should be doing. And all sort of copying each other in this, and then it will all lead to sprint finishes being much safer for everyone. But that's certainly what they showed us today, that Visma Lisa Bike stayed faithful to that policy that we heard outlined by Mark Rafe yesterday. Should we talk now, Pelacci, about not tomorrow's stage, but the stage that comes the day after that, back in Italy?
La tappa di domani, la cena di ieri. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner.
Pelacci, not tomorrow, but dopodomani, the day after tomorrow, we are going to be in Calabria. We're going to talk about that in just a second. But before we do, Pelacci, we're going back to Italy. And tomorrow we are going to have an episode. And it's going to be your fantastic Kilometre Zero for Friends of the Podcast. And it is a very Italian story, because it's about the Italian National Championships last year, won by Filippo Conca. The title is the hold-up of the century.
Yep.
And it's this great David versus Goliath story of a rider from a club team, not even a Continental Division pro team, winning the Italian National Championships, winning the tricolour jersey. And he's not here at the Giro d'Italia. And your Kilometre Zero tells that story and it's coming out tomorrow.
I caught up with them at the Strade Bianche this year, thanks to Cycling Podcast, and amazing experience for me being there and talking to them. What a great story. Won't spoil anything, but there are chiacchierate with Conca, Gaffuri, another World Tour cyclist now, and with some former alpine skiers who did something interesting in cycling.
Indeed, indeed. So that's the hold up of the century that's coming for Friends of the Podcast tomorrow. That is Monday. Pelacci, let's talk now. Well, actually, we're not going to talk. We're going to hand over to someone who knows the lie of the land in Calabria, which is where we're going much better than us. I'm talking about Valerio Bianco, who is a friend of ours. He's one of the press officers, the press chiefs, the sort of, well, he's in charge of the media at the Giro d'Italia, and he's very much a dyed-in-the-wool, we say in English, Calabrian. And the race on Tuesday will pass very close to where Valerio is from, so we got him to present Tuesday's stage. Valerio, you're a rare Calabrese who's working in cycling, because Calabria is not a region that's well known for cycling, but you know tomorrow's stage. Present it to us, for us.
Well, it's a very tricky stage. It comes after the rest day, so it's always a complicated day. It's quite flat on the coast, just 50 kilometers to go. It starts the climb that is called Cozzotunno, but everyone is calling it La Crocetta, which is the climb that separates the two provinces, province of Catanzaro, the start, and the province of Cosenza. And after Crocetta, we go downhill and we go to Cosenza, which is not my hometown, but almost my hometown. So yeah, I'm very happy to see the Giro coming back after 40 years.
Give us some local, give us, what have we got, a necklace here?
My necklace is the necklace of my region, Calabria. Was given me by my girlfriend. I bought her the one of Sicily and she bought me the one of Calabria.
Beautiful. And you're a fan of Cosenza. No, you're also a fan of Milan, aren't you, football team? But you're also a fan of Cosenza, known as the Lupi, the Wolf.
Yeah. The main team is Cosenza, not Milan. Like Milan, because I grew up in Milan, but my team is Cosenza, the Lupi. Even if we are living bad times, but yeah.
Okay. Valerio, just to finish, three important things that people should know about the regions that the Giro goes through tomorrow. I'm thinking things they might already know about Calabria. Ndugia, for example.
We have a lot of spicy peppers. We have Ndugia, we have Soppressata.
So the correct pronunciation is Ndugia.
Ndugia on my side, but on the in the side of Vibo Valencia, people might call it Ndugia. But on my side is Ndugia. And it's a region well known for the beaches. We have 80% of blue flag of beaches. But also we have a lot of mountains. I come from the mountains. I come from Sila. Not, I don't come from the sea. And the third most important thing is that Cosenza is the best team in the region. Even someone at the start will not say the same.
Forza Lupi.
Forza Lupi.
Pelacci, you won't be with me. Brian will. You'll be coming back in Tuscany. Looking forward to getting to Italy, of course. Looking forward to getting to Calabria. I feel as though we haven't really talked that much about Bulgarian food, wine, the places where we've been staying. And last night, unfortunately, we had to take what we were given because we got to the hotel after a very long drive, very late. So in the hotel where we were staying in Stara Zagora, with its wonderful, wonderful park where we ran this morning.
Amazing.
Pelacci. They had quite an international menu, didn't
they? Yep,
and
they did.
It wasn't very authentically Bulgarian. We did have some very authentic Bulgarian wine, red wine, Volcano, it was called, the wine produced by the Damianica winery in the Struma River Valley. You can kind of taste the volcanic soil in the, it was a Shiraz, a Syrah wine, and that was very good indeed. But we've really not done very well in terms of sampling the Bulgarian cuisine, apart from the banitsa yesterday.
But I would say this is our fault, Daniele, because we were not given proper possibilities to discover.
Not our fault.
Local food, yeah, because we've been to international restaurants that did not serve local food, such as, and I'm reading from the Garibaldi, sarma, it means the meat, or kavarma, it's pork, or supa topceta, a soup made from beef or pork meatballs. So we could not do it. It's not our fault.
No, Pelacci. We were talking in the car, weren't we, about the fact that, well, this is, people hate hearing this because they think we live the high life, Pelacci. They think we live the high life. But when we talk about press buffets, and the Giro d'Italia remains, I mean, you say what you want about the quality of the Giro d'Italia, Bardiani breakaways, Polti visit Malta, but as far as buffets are concerned, the Giro d'Italia, it's not even, there's no photo, as they say in Italian, is there? Nope. It's not close between the Giro d'Italia, the Vuelta, and the Tour. And what usually happens at the Giro d'Italia is, and I don't know who's in charge of this actually in RCS, Pelacci, but there must be someone who's in charge of this. Maybe it's our friend Lo Zio Stefano Diciateo, long-serving press chief himself. But conversations are had and agreements are made with often it's local sort of hospitality, I don't know if that's the right word, or culinary schools. And often we get buffets where you get a lot of young people in beautiful chef's overalls. Yep. And they have done their absolute very best, a whole team, a whole army of them, done their very best to lay on a fantastic and opulent sort of banquet of all of the regional specialities. So we're spoiled at the Giro d'Italia. We were saying in the car today that the way to the journalists' hearts often is through their stomachs, and it's kind of unfortunate. It's a bit of a shame that we haven't had anything. There have been no buffets, to be clear, yep. Not even bad buffets. There have been no buffets, nothing for the press in Bulgaria, and that's been a little bit of a shame in the sense that it's also denied us an opportunity to sample more of the local cuisine. And it feels like an easy win. It's an easy win for a country. When you think of what they're spending, and we've heard what they're spending, many, many millions on this Giro d'Italia, and we as journalists are not as important as the media once was in transmitting the message about what we've seen here and what we've experienced here. It used to be very important to sort of curry the favour of the journalists. It's not as important anymore, and there aren't that many of us here. But still, unfortunately, and maybe it shows that we can be easily bought, if you do treat the journalists well, you're probably going to get more favourable coverage. True.
And I also eat a lot, so I miss buffet a lot. I was talking to Daniele this morning, then we'll talk about the Calabrian stage, but this morning with Andy, a listener of the podcast from Australia, about the Bina Ghirmai champagne pop stage in Jesi. That day we had a buffet when I could try Paccasassi, a typical sort of local herb that grows in the sea in Le Marche. Amazing memory. Nothing.
Alas, I'm reliably informed that things will improve on the buffet front as soon as we get to Italy. And certainly the second half of the Giro, I was assured today, is looking very, very good. But actually, you'll be back for the second half of the Giro, so you'll be enjoying those wonderful buffets with me. We'll be back on Tuesday. Don't forget tomorrow, friends of the podcast, Pelacci's hold up of the century will hit the airwaves. Pelacci, thank you very much for your company over the last 3-4 days. I've really enjoyed it, and I look forward to seeing you again in Tuscany.
Ciao, Daniele.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.